Welcome to America.
Thank you.
I guess you're somewhat familiar with it. You have some of the scenes in the Book of Evidence take place in Berkeley.
Mm-hmm. My wife's American. She went to school in Berkeley.
Uh-huh. So you spent some time there?
Yeah.
Uh-huh. Tell me a little bit about you. I understand you're the literary editor of the Irish Times.
The Irish Times, yes, in Dublin. I haven't been writing for a couple of years, and I've been doing this job for a couple of years, but I've just started a new book now, so I begin to wonder which of them is going to pull me the hardest.
Which of what? The job?
Which of my jobs?
Which of your jobs, yeah. Well, I can tell you which is going to pull you the hardest. I would say there's probably nothing harder than the literary effort, and one can see that you expended a tremendous amount of effort in this novel. Isn't writing one of the hardest jobs in the world?
Yes, it is. It's absolutely appalling. There are various stages of it. The stage I'm at the moment where I'm starting a book is wonderful. You know, you think this is going to be the masterpiece. This is the one that's going to excuse all the mistakes I've made in the past. It's only when you get about 6 months into it that you realize what a terrible thing you've taken on, you know, and you get horrified by the task in hand. But this is a good stage, the planning stage, where you start to put the first paragraphs down. Anything is possible.
How did it all start for you? You grew up in Dublin, is that correct?
I grew up in a small town to the south of Dublin called Wexford. And I moved to Dublin when I was about 17 or 18. I had been writing since I was in my teens, since I was about 13 or 14. Terrible short stories, which I destroyed. I hope I managed to destroy them all so the world would never see them. And then I published the first book of short stories and a novella when I was about 24 in 1970. And I've published about 7 books since then.
Did you grow up in a literary household?
No. No, I didn't. I think books and writing was for me part of the adolescent rebellion. It was something that my parents didn't care very much for, and therefore I suppose I loved it all the more. But I knew from very early on that I wanted to be a writer. I tried briefly to paint, which was totally and utterly disastrous. I really hadn't a notion how to put lines or color onto paper. But it did make me look at the world in new ways. Look at the world more closely, and I think that's paid off in the writing.
That's unusual. You say that writing was a form of adolescent rebellion. Most adolescents find other forms of rebellion, such as joyriding and going on beer busts and breaking windows and things like that.
This was a long time ago, and we were all better behaved, I suppose. No, I wouldn't want to make too much of it being rebellion, but it was certainly... Growing up in a small town, as anybody who grows up in a small town knows, the constant thought in one's mind is escape to a bigger world. Like Chekhov's Three Sisters, you know, I want to go to Moscow. And I suppose books were an escape, a place to escape to inside one's head.
Still, growing up in a small town opens a window of intimacy that a big city does not enjoy, don't you think? You get to know neighbors and relatives in a more intimate way.
Yes, especially, and in Ireland it was particularly interesting, because in small towns there the classes intermingle much more than they do in the city. Family was, you know, middle class, lower middle class, shading to middle class, let's put it that way. But my friends were all people from the tennis clubs and people who rode horses and that kind of set. And not particularly because I was snobbish, but because they were just the people I happened to know. So it gave one a sort of cross-section of society, which was interesting.
Well, let's talk a little bit about the Book of Evidence, and then I want to ask you a couple of questions about Irish literary life. This really an interesting book and so well done. Tell me a little bit about the origins of this novel.
Well, all my books, I think, are about people who are obsessed with what Wallace Stevens called the rage for order. I've written about astronomers such as Copernicus and Kepler, whom I saw as men who wished to find some kind of order, some kind of structure in a chaotic world. My protagonist in this book, Freddie Montgomery, may seem a very long way away from them, but he is the same kind of person who feels that the world is pretty well unbearable unless one can find some sort of pattern to impose on it. And at one stage in his life he's been a scientist of some kind, at least he claims to have been. I'm not quite sure that he's telling the truth about that. And he threw it all up and just began to drift and was one of those faintly aristocratic drifters that one meets in various ports in southern Europe. One probably meets them in America as well. He rather fancies himself as a gentleman of leisure. And then he comes back to Ireland, where he was born, and he stumbles into committing a very bloody crime, a very bloody murder. And he doesn't know why. When he tries to find a reason for it, the strongest emotion he can remember was one of impatience. Somebody got in his way and he just lashed out and killed this person.
Incredibly, somewhere toward the end, Freddie said that if the opportunity arose, he would do it again.
He just means that he can't see that he would have lived differently a second time around. He feels that he is locked in an inevitable process, which again, I suppose, is part of his desire for stability, even if the stability means that he will do dreadful things again. I don't believe that Freddie would kill again. I think this is one fact that does redeem him somewhat. I think that he wouldn't do it again, having known what it was like the first time. But he can't be sure. But he thinks that if he were given his life to live over again, he knows that it would go as it did the first time and he would commit this crime again.
Now, Freddie is the narrator of this book, and the book is written in the form of a confession to the court. But it would seem to me that as you read it, Freddie is not just obsessed, but he's almost certifiably mad.
I don't know that he's mad. He's certainly desperate. I think we have to... He fancies himself, as I say, as a gentleman, as a rather elegant character, and he tries to keep up an elegant and cool tone. But I think we keep seeing in the strain of various pages and various sentences, we see his predicament. He is in jail for life. In many ways, his life has come to an end. And he's trying to keep up a front. He's trying to keep the mask in place, but it keeps slipping. But I don't think he's mad. I think perhaps he's maddened by having committed this crime and not knowing why, but I don't think that he is insane.
Freddie may fancy himself elegant, but he's also petty, stiffing the taxi driver, for example, rifling through his friend's desk for cash and credit cards and things.
He's a pretty horrible man. There's no doubting that. But he is at least claims to be absolutely honest. He's doing a sort of like Rousseau in his Confessions. He's saying, I will reveal everything, even the worst sides of myself. Of course, many of the worst things that he reveals, he's not aware of revealing. He thinks that he's keeping the mask in place, but actually we see the monstrous figure behind it.
I once had an editor say of a book that I wrote that I can't publish this, the characters are too unpleasant. But that seems to be a specious explanation for not wanting to publish a book, because certainly this your protagonist is a very unpleasant character. So that should not be a justifiable cause for not publishing a book, should it?
I certainly wouldn't think so. No, that would be imposing a kind of moral censorship on one that is not very praiseworthy. No, Freddie is unpleasant, but Freddie has his good sides. He certainly loves and cherishes the world, the mere surface of the world. He is at great pains to try to paint what he sees and what he remembers as accurately and as lovingly as possible. And that, in a way, is a kind of moral action. I mean, after all, what he's producing, whether it's good or bad, he is producing a work of art. And that's a sort of, that's a moral gesture in a bad world.
Your book was a critical success in Ireland and England, wasn't it?
Yes, it was. It was.
Wasn't it nominated for the Booker Prize?
It was shortlisted for the Booker Prize, yes, and was sort of joint favorite with Kazuo Ishiguro, who won in the end. Yes, it was, and that makes an awful lot of difference on that side of the Atlantic. I don't think America takes prizes quite as seriously as we do. I think you're more sensible over here.
Well, I'm not. I wouldn't go that far. Someone who puts the kind of effort that you put in your book, I think, would certainly find a prize such as the American Book Award or the National Book Award or the Pulitzer or one of these others. Welcome news. Well, how does the Booker Prize work? Is it only the British Commonwealth or what?
Yes, it's Commonwealth and Republic of Ireland.
That include Australia and Canada?
Australia, Canada,
South
India,
Africa.
South Africa. It's an extraordinary thing, really. Paul Theroux has been living in London for the past 20 years. He's very sore that Americans who've been living there for a long time are not allowed in to take part in it. Because most people feel that they forget that he's American, it's been there so long, and they assume that his publishers did submit his book, but that it was rejected, so he gets very annoyed about that, and I don't blame him. But I think it's felt that if American authors were allowed in, that the prize would just come to America every year, because American fiction is so strong.
Well,
I doubt they would admit that, but I suspect that is the... That's part of the thinking behind it.
Well, then it's not for... The Booker Prize is not for authors who just live in the Commonwealth, but those who are citizens or subjects.
I think you have to have been born in the Commonwealth or in the Republic of Ireland. I think that's the point.
I don't believe that would apply in this country to almost any major prize. This nation is built on so many nationalities that it would be very difficult to refuse an award.
Yeah. Yeah.
Well, now tell me about your work on the London Times.
On the Dublin.
Oh, I'm sorry. Of course I knew that. The Dublin Times.
It's the Irish Times newspaper, and there's a weekend supplement, as most newspapers have now, and there are two full book pages in that, which I edit. It's good. I enjoy it. I feel like a child at a candy store. New books crossing my desk every day. My problem is I don't like to give them away. I'd have to keep them all for myself.
I know. I had to rent a storage room in a warehouse in Upper Manhattan to store my books. It's a very difficult process to give them away.
I'm going to be doing that myself fairly soon. But
do you do the reviews yourself, or do you assign them, or what?
Oh, I assign them. I just do about one review a month. That's all. I really haven't time to do more than that. But the assigning of reviews and matching books to reviewers is it's enjoyable, but it takes time. It takes energy. It takes energy trying to persuade people to review things as well.
Do you pay them or just give them the book?
Oh, I pay them. Not very much, but I do pay. But if you try to get celebrities to review books, especially people who see themselves as celebrities, then you have to put an awful lot of flattery into your tone in order to get them to do it. I find that
Do you ever run across an occasion where you assign a book to a reviewer and the reviewer has a grudge against that particular author?
Well, not that I know of. Dublin's a very small town, but one would have a fair idea about who has grudges against whom. So I try to... For the most part, I try to... Books by Irish people, you know, new Irish novels, I will try to have them reviewed by people outside the country.
Dublin has quite a literary tradition, doesn't it?
Yes, it does. It's still quite strong. This year is extraordinary. There are about, I think there's about 15 to 20 new novels coming out by Irish people living in Ireland now. And I mean, that may not seem a great number, but the population is about 3.5-4 million people. So they've all obviously been scribbling away like mad for the past 4 or 5 years. And it's very good to see. A lot of the books, I haven't read them all, obviously, but the ones I've seen so far are good. Because there had been a sort of slump for a while in the 60s and 70s. There really wasn't very much being produced. But suddenly all these young people have come along. Terrifies old, grey old people like me are terrified at the prospect of all these young Turks coming in to take over from me, you know. But it's good to see that maybe, you know, the tradition is reasserting itself.
The Book of Evidence has nothing to do with what is known as the Troubles in Ireland, but I have this feeling that, well, it's not a feeling, I just don't know, so I'll just ask you, do you think that, how much of the modern literary effort is put into studying the problems in Northern Ireland and the relationship between Ireland and Britain?
I think we all avoid, if we can, writing about it directly, because it's still going on. It's very difficult to know. It's very difficult to judge what's going on, what's happening, what the future is going to be. But obviously, if one lives in a very troubled country like Ireland, those troubles are going to have an effect, even if it's a subconscious effect on what one does. Certainly the Book of Evidence is, there is an atmosphere of violence in it, which I suspect comes from the kind of things that are happening in the north and which we hear on the radio and the news every day.
And in fact, there's a bombing in the...
There is a bombing, and I wanted to keep that firmly in the background because we've become used to the violence in Ireland. I mean, it's, you know, one has to. We can't keep... human beings are just not capable of showing the same kind of horror day after day after day after day. One does get used to it. And I think of life in Ireland as a life rather, in the way that Freddie described it, it is a beautiful country, and Dublin is a fine place to live. But every now and then there are faint echoes of bombings that one hears almost subliminally in one's head. I don't mean real physical echoes of bombings, but it's there always behind us like a bad dream. And it does affect books such as the Book of Evidence, I think. But, you know, I should emphasize that, as you began by saying, it's not directly about the North, but obviously the North and the troubles there do have an effect on it.
Actually, I see Ireland and Dublin is rather idyllic. It's the north where we have this grim picture of the violence.
Know, yes, it's true, but Belfast is about 120 miles away from Dublin. You know,
I'm sorry?
Belfast is about 120 miles away from Dublin. It's the north is just up the road, literally. And I still find it strange when I'm driving from Dublin to the north to visit friends of mine, to be stopped at the border by very heavily armed soldiers and policemen. And I almost, you know, I realize that I've almost forgotten just what's going on until I get there. It really is quite extraordinary how one does get used to horrors.
You mean they actually stop you? You can't just... I know Northern Ireland is a separate country, but it...
Oh, you certainly, like, you're certainly like stopped at customs. And frequently there will be army checkpoints. I mean, I don't think I've ever driven across the border, but there wasn't a checkpoint of some kind. But, I mean, you know, they're perfectly polite. You just tell us your name, and where you're going, where you're from, and so on.
It's rather that way between the United States and Canada. You just wave something out the window and go across, and there are miles and miles of border that, well, there's nobody there. I guess you could just wade across if it's a lake or walk across a field or something like that.
But, it, you know, you do worry when you're sitting in the car and you roll the window down and this incredibly well-armed soldier comes along, you know, in an English accent. Starts to talk to you, and you realize that, you know, if your foot slipped on the accelerator, or if the car backfired or something, you know, a nervous 19-year-old soldier might well blow your head off. I mean, it has happened. So it does bring the reality of it home to you. And also, I was driving to Belfast to see friends of mine, and I hadn't ever driven into Belfast before. And I took a wrong turning, and I ended up in a loyalist area, and my car was a Southern registration, and I turned and hightailed out of there as quickly as I could, which is, you know, probably nobody would have harmed me, but the very fact that I was terrified to be in the wrong street, which was parallel to you know, a street 20 yards away where I would have felt safe, makes you realize how complex and intractable the problem is there.
Well, I think you expressed it pretty well. If you focus all your energies on the political strife, of course, that is the major preoccupation in Ireland today. But if you do it in such a direct way, sometimes I think a writer, possibly, I'm only theorizing now, would lose sight of other elements in a person's life and development, because the political life in Ireland is not the only thing that exists. Isn't that true?
Yes, you. Well, for a start, I don't think that you can start to write a book or paint a picture or do a piece of music with a specific program in mind, you know, a specific plan. I'm now going to address the question of blah, 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 or I'm now going to speak to a specific audience. I think that you have to do the book as well as you can for itself. And I think that mostly when writers sit down, they forget about audience or message or content. They simply want to get the thing done as well as it can possibly be done. I certainly feel that when I write. And I frequently look at books afterwards and start to realize what I was doing in them without knowing it at the time. Since I've been in America talking to people about the book, I've discovered lots of things I didn't know were in it. Simply by talking about it and going back over it and remembering it. So I think one does, to some extent, work, I won't say subconsciously or unconsciously, but one works in a sort of dreamlike way, in a way that you know, how marvelously inventive the sleeping mind is. These marvelous dreams keep being devised. And at the time we're dreaming, we don't know why we're doing it. We don't have any meaning, but frequently next day we'd say, oh yes, I dreamt that because of such and such, and we'll do our Freudian interpretation of it. But while we're dreaming, it's merely the dream that concerns us. And I think art is somewhat like that. It is a sort of state of dreaming.
Well, if one writes a political tract in the guise of art, it's going to go out of date. And I cite some American playwrights of the 1930s, Clifford Odets, Maxwell Anderson, who wrote highly acclaimed plays for their day, but they're so out of date, to read them today, they don't make any sense at all.
No, it's true. Yeah. I mean, I often think of the example of someone writing a very passionate novel about the Boer War, and, you know, what happens to the novel when the Boer War ends? You know, any forgotten little war like that, dreadful as it was at the time. I think one has to approach things in art from a sort of crabwise, from the side, glancing from the corner of one's eye at the problem.
Ireland has an extreme oral tradition too, doesn't it? Storytelling tradition, doesn't it?
Yes, and I think I did quite a few readings in the Book of Evidence when the book came out in Ireland, and it struck me how rhetorical it is. Admittedly, some of that was intentional, because I wanted Freddie to... he was writing the book as if he were giving an address from the dock to the judge in court. But even taking that into account, there is an oratorical swing to the sentences that I wasn't really aware of until I started to read it aloud. And I suppose that must come from the tradition. Certainly we talk in Ireland, probably talk too much. We talk ourselves into the most appalling situations, and a great many talented people have talked their talents away, which is something that the Irish have to be aware of. We love words, we're drunk on words. We love the sound of our own voices.
Well, the Irish have wonderful voices as well. Ireland also treats its artists very well, too, in terms of taxation, doesn't it?
Very well indeed. I don't pay tax on my earnings in my books. There is also an organization called Eas Dóna, which was set up by the state. And it has a membership of about 150 artists, painters, writers. And anyone who can show that they earn under a certain amount will get about, I think it's about $12,000 or so, $12,000 a year, which is not a fantastic amount of money, but if you're earning just a very small amount from your work, you know, it does supplement it and helps to feed the kids. So it's a very, very good thing, and especially for such a small country. I think it's an extraordinary thing. I took 3 years off from newspaper work to finish a book, and during those 3 years I was supported by that organization. So it's very enlightened legislation, I think.
What about the people, your neighbors, friends, when they find out you're a writer and not having to pay taxes and getting a subsidy, well, how do they react to that?
I think that the Irish have a peculiar respect, I think, for writers. I mean, I know that may sound strange when you think of the way that people like Joyce felt about Ireland and the way that so many people were censored. But censorship is a form of respect. I mean, you only bother to censor things that you're afraid of and that you think have real weight and that are dangerous. I think that people generally approve of tax-free status for artists. Obviously, there will be a certain amount of annoyance. I don't blame them, especially in a country where taxation is so high. But the amounts of money that people earn in Ireland from art is very little anyway. There are very few people there in Ireland who are, millionaires who are getting away tax-free. I mean, most of them are just people who are scratching a living, and if they had to pay tax, would possibly leave.
And in fact, most writers in this country scratch for a living. I mean, there are a few who can live on it. Probably not more than a few hundred writers who can live expressly. I'm talking about literary writers on their earnings. The rest have to supplement their work by teaching or get grants or whatever. Yeah. But you mentioned censorship, but there's no censorship in Ireland, is there?
There is a censorship board,
Is there really?
Oh, yes. I mean, you can't buy Playboy or...
Playboy?
Magazine. Oh, yes.
Rather benign.
No, but it's banned. It's banned in Ireland. And...
Did this book have to go before the censorship board?
No, it does... The way that it's, as usual, it's an Irish organization, so it's extremely peculiar. There is a censorship board, and the way that they work is a member of the public has to bring a book or a magazine to their attention. They will then consider whether or not to ban it. And they recently banned, again, I mean, they renewed the ban on Alex Comfort's Joy of Sex. And I think J.P. Dunleavy's The Ginger Man is, I think it's still banned. Ulysses was never banned. And as I say, Playboy and all girly magazines are all banned. That's not such a bad thing, but it's a little ludicrous.
Well, what are you and other writers doing to eradicate this censorship war?
Well, one of us submitted the Bible to the censorship board recently.
Was that banned too?
Said that it should be banned because it was absolutely reeking, full of sex and violence. And it gave the board quite a lot of trouble, you know, that they had to come up with a good, if they had banned Alex Comfort's perfectly harmless book, probably Joy of Sex probably helps people. If they could ban that, then they would have to come up with a good reason for not banning the Bible, which, as I say, is full of sex and violence. And they did come up with a sort of a two-page, completely solemn explanation of why they wouldn't ban the Bible, essentially saying it was so popular that they couldn't, which I thought was a good reason. But it really doesn't. It doesn't have very much power now, the censorship board. And I think most of us feel that if we just ignore it, it will wither on the vine and just fall away.
Well, you know, Playboy.
We feel that if we make a fuss about it, it will.
Playboy has published some of the great American fiction in the last couple of decades.
Well, Sean Fuelon had a short story published in Playboy, and when they were sending him his complimentary copies, they were seized at customs. And this was in the 1970s, you know, I mean, it wasn't in the 1930s.
But there are people who want to censor us, and there's always been groups, there have always been groups in the United States where there is virtually no censorship. There are still efforts to censor. I mean, censorship boards spring up. Once in a while, misguided prosecutors decide to go after a magazine. There's all sorts of intimidation. The most stringent, the most well-known case currently is over the an artist by the name of Mapplethorpe, who has an exhibit of photographs in Cincinnati. Now it's being shown, but they're prosecuting the museum. I don't know whether they're going to win or not, but it's a constant battle, and it always has been. Mm-hmm. But there was a day in this country when we accepted censorship. I remember as a kid going to the movies, and as the movie, before the movie began, it would be on the screen, approved by the censorship board of the state of Maryland or Ohio or whatever.
We still have that. And frequently films will be cut or banned. I always remember going to see the film of Night of the Iguana, and there was a scene in it where Albert Gardner was turning to Richard Burton. And all she was allowed to say was, "You," but the rest was cut, you know. You know, it's so pathetic, really, so silly, as if the audience had never heard such words before, you know. Crazy. But as I say, we feel that if we start complaining too strenuously, that it will just get a hornet's nest going, and that all kinds of people will start leaping out of the woodwork and start calling for censorship as, you know.
But how does it work? Say you write a book that now you have a sex scene in here involving two women and a man, and what happens if somebody complained about it and said, "Hey, there's a menage a trois scene in this book that shouldn't be here, and this book should be banned."
Somebody may well have done that.
Well, what happens?
They would send the book to the censorship board, or they would tell the censorship board about this book. The censorship board is then obliged to examine the book and deliver a judgment on it. But it's all, I mean, I wouldn't know about it.
But what happens if they say, "Well, this book is obscene"? Then what happens?
Well, then they would ban it.
What happens if the publisher, the writer, or the book distributors refuse to take it away? What happens?
They'd be prosecuted.
Everybody?
Books would be seized at customs. And,
in customs? Books already in the country.
Yeah. But, I mean, I really shouldn't. We shouldn't get carried away. I cannot imagine such a thing happening in this day and age. I really can't. But it did happen up to recently. A good friend of mine, John McGahan, superb novelist, his first book was banned back in the 60s. And he was sacked from his job as a teacher. And he had to leave the country. And, you know, that was the 60s. I mean, that's not very long ago. I really can't see it happening now. At least, you know, there's a certain amount of wishful thinking that I hope it can't happen now.
John Banville, I have to let you go. I'm told that you have another appointment, and I promise I'd get you out before 1:45. The Book of Evidence, it's a startling psychological murder case, and it's a really it's a tremendous book. I thank you very, very much.
Thank you.